Good morning and welcome to Manga Explaining, the show where we recommend great manga to folks who haven't read much manga before. And Christopher laughed and threw me off, but I'm going to leave it in. Hosted by Zeb Aoki, Christopher Woodrow Butcher, Chip Zdarsky, and myself, David Brothers. Follow along with our show notes and reading list at mangaexplaining.com. I don't know why I have so much trouble saying follow along. It's a lot of L's in there.
Mm.
But Speaking of L's, we're here to talk about manga.
This is maybe the greatest opening.
Yeah, this is just, you're just going for it.
Yeah, dude. No, I just woke up. No, let me try that one again.
No, you're not.
Yeah, we'll just roll into it. This is a live manga explaining.
Speaking of L, you were going to do the move.
Move.
But then my head was like, wait, that's not good enough. That's not enough of a joke to open the podcast with. Try again. So it reset. Right. But no, we are here to talk about Jiro Taniguchi's Guardians of the Louvre, published by NBM Graphic Novels in association, collaboration with the Louvre, translated by Kumar Subbasubramanian. And the lettering credits were very tiny. It's by Ilwin Tidings, which I'm not super familiar with, but
I don't think that's like an Alan Smithy lettering credit, I think.
Yeah, right. If you work for Ilwin, hit us up, tell us your name, we'll put you in the credits. It'll be a nice time. But Guardians of the Louvre is a book that I pitched with one of my all time worst pitches on the podcast, to the point where Deb and Christopher actually saved it for me. Chip picked it first for our, fifth season of Mangasplaining here. Essentially, Guardians of the Louvre is the latest entry in the Louvre collection of graphic novels. They've done several books with a variety of cartoonists, including JoJo's Bizarre Adventures, Hirohiko Araki. In this one, Jiro Taniguchi, manga legend, incredible drawer of men in suits, a character takes a group trip to Europe. He stops in Paris and he gets sick. And while he's in his hotel room, he's kind of hallucinating and feeling really ill. And he decides, I'm just going to go to the Louvre and see a bunch of paintings and kind of discover art history. And over the course of that kind of journey of discovery, let's say, he meets some paintings. They talk to him. He meets some loved ones. He gains some insight into art and the Louvre and kind of what it takes to run one of the biggest and most important art museums in the world over the past, however many years. I thought this would be fun to read for the podcast because Taniguchi's a great cartoonist. His last book we did, A Journal of My Father, destroyed the podcast. And I was thinking this one might be a little less emotionally intense, but still kind of interesting since, we work in the arts, working artists, working cartoonists, writers, we're all people we have a vested interest in art history, let's say. And this, surprisingly, is kind of a explainer manga about art history.
Yeah.
So I think bringing this to the show would be kind of fun. It's a little different format than we're used to. It's a full color manga. It took me a minute to figure out whether it was printed left to right or right to left, because I'm reading the digital version that I got from the Hoopla Library app, but it's in print. It's on eBooks as well. You can find it pretty much anywhere. And I want to start with Deb and get her take on Guardians of the Louvre by Jiro Taniguchi.
Well, it is an explainer manga for sure.
Yeah.
Maybe it helps because I've been to the Louvre several times and I'm really familiar with the places and the paintings that he's describing here.
Mm-hmm.
I like that he's very realistic about the fact that the Louvre is very crowded. And most people will just run to the Mona Lisa and jam around it and take selfies. And then he makes this little remark that's not exactly art appreciation anymore, is it? Mm. So there's some little biting things in here, but mostly, I will say that there's a lot of things that were new. Like he mentioned the Japanese artists who were really influenced and did residencies in France. So that was interesting. A little side note, my copy was on my shelf wrapped, meaning I had not unwrapped it because I vaguely remember Christopher saying, this is actually the lamest one of his words.
Wow.
Sneak peek at Chris.
And then I didn't bother to open it, I guess.
Yeah. Did you like it this time, though?
It's nice. Oh, it's okay. Like I said, it's kind of like a Jiro Taniguchi guidebook through the Louvre. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have, the kind of narrative that we love from him.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like he had to try to pick things, but it does feel like he was very curated about what he decided to focus on. think that was meaningful to him versus, you know, the greatest hits of the Louvre, right? Like things that he personally thought was interesting and worth talking about. I love the part where they were talking that chapter about saving the paintings of the Louvre from the Nazis.
Yeah.
That was cool.
Awesome. And Christopher, any comment?
Was I remembering this wrong, Christopher? Because I'm not sure.
No, you were 100% right. If I was like quoted on the back of this book, it would be one of those like there's ellipses before and after my quote, like ... an artistic tour de force ... Christopher Butcher manga explaining an artistic tour de force, but easily the least of Jiro Taniguchi's works that I've read. And I feel bummed saying that because I've actually read like a lot of Taniguchi, and it's I don't know exactly where to start, but I will say that he only did a couple books after this before he passed away. Furari was one of them. It's black and white, set in the samurai period. He did the Venice book, which is probably the closest to this, where he just sort of went to Venice and painted landscapes, and occasionally there'd be like a couple of inset panels. So it kind of implied a narrative, sort of like if The Walking Man, which isn't part of the show canon, but is part of, I think three of us have read it. It had even less of a like obvious narrative. It's basically just him wandering through Venice and painting and showing gorgeous things and his like, you know, suited, jacketed character doing that.
Basically on the dime of Louis Vuitton, by the way.
Yeah.
We should all aspire to that.
Yeah, we really should. He did a children's picture book about forests. That was his last work. I think it was even incompleted, but I think someone completed it after his death. It's later in his life. He just moved to this point where about half of his work was travelogues and just drawing beautiful scenery. And I think those are really good. His Venice sketchbook, as it's called, is beautiful. It's amazing, amazing work. And this feels like it could have been a Louvre sketchbook, a Paris sketchbook. And the superimposition of the narrative onto it ruined it, I think. I think the narrative has a couple of really interesting ideas, but it is easily one of the prettiest books we've ever read on the podcast. Mm-hmm. Everything from the actual architecture of the Louvre and of Paris itself to going through and redrawing all these paintings that are in the Louvre and sculptures, capturing them in his own style and in the styles of the artists, depending on who painted it, is like the art of it is absolutely incredible and beautiful. But the story of it, I feel like, I get what he was going for, but it doesn't work. It just doesn't work, unfortunately, in my opinion. So yeah.
What doesn't it's a work beautiful about book, it, though. Out of curiosity, like the story is kind of the guy visiting Paris and kind of going back and forth between art milestones, I guess, like hallucinating.
It was all a dream, or was it?
Yeah.
It was all a dream, or was it, is like a bad place to start the story, in my opinion. Even in the third and fourth chapter, he's like, am I still dreaming? Like, and then the fifth chapter with the like resolution was like, and I get it. And it's on one level, it is heartfelt, but on the other level, it as story, it's just badly constructed. Like the big denouement, and I guess we're going to spoil it because we spoil everything, he's actually at the Louvre because he made a promise to somebody that was really important to him that when she was sick, when she got better, they'd meet again one day at the Louvre and he'd take her there, and he goes on her own to like honor her memory, except she isn't introduced until she shows up at the end. So there's no weight to the resolution. There's just like one tiny line of text that hints that he's looking for somebody, but it's never even expanded upon. So it's just like, oh man, like you could have done this 100 different ways that would have been stories. And instead it's just like,
Yeah.
And I have more, but I always have more.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to shut up. So Chip, in what way am I wrong? Please let me know.
Oh, where to begin with this, my favorite manga of all time. I will say this might be the greatest sponsored comic of all time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because when I started reading it, I started to think back to like all the crappy Marvel ones, like like Spider-Man visits the Calgary Stampede or Captain America like celebrates the Golden State Warriors, like whatever. Like it's a whole business of like of like Marvel especially. I don't know if DC does it, but like having these weird sponsor deal comics.
DC did, but the Subway one was so disastrous with Jared, you know?
Oh, oh no. Whoa. I don't think I knew about that one.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Marvel had their disastrous one a few years ago where it's like
Raytheon, Marvel, I think.
Yeah, yeah, with a defense contractor or whatever. Yeah. Like, hey kids. And it's it's always been like this weird separate thing. So like on that level, this is the most successful one of those I've definitely ever read.
Mm-hmm.
More successful than when Spider-Man met the Montreal Expos, for sure. And I agree, I'm probably not as vocally with Chris that this doesn't really work too much as a narrative because there's not really a character progression except that he's just kind of learning about this stuff. And again, the thing about it's his wife, I believe, at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's like a couple of pages before she shows up. I got the page where he's like, the accident. It's been more than 3 years since it happened. When I think of my wife, what I lost was too great.
Oh, like, right.
And it kind of hits like, it hits strangely as a mention at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I suppose the reasoning is because if they did it early on, it'd be like, okay, well, we'll wait for the wife to show up since he's dreaming. Right?
Like, yeah.
He's kind of blown it all just by being upfront with the fact that is this dream? Is this reality? I will say the dream and the crowds was a kind of a smart way to address the crowd problem without having to draw people throughout your entire thing.
<That's fair.
laughs> The art is stunning. It is beautiful. I always have a weird issue when, especially in a case like this where you're explaining art, to have drawings of paintings because you're never actually showing people what it's about because you're doing this weird way of reproducing the painting. It works a bit better with statues, I suppose, but like with a painting, it's just like, oh, okay. Like this crosshatch thing with like a light wash under it is important as much as this crosshatch thing with a light wash under it. I found that very distracting when they would get into the intricacies of a painting. I agree with Deb. I think the part about the history of saving the artwork, I think the whole thing should have been about that. Mm-hmm. I think that's a story.
Yeah.
Like imagine that just having that story, no fill in kind of narrator for the artist, but just like, oh my God, the Nazis are coming. Mm-hmm. Like, what do we do? What do we focus on? Like there's such a great story there about like, do I get my family out of town before this? Like what, like where do your convictions lie and where do your priorities lie when something like that is happening?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's an amazing story to be done there.
That's Liv, go call Chip Zdarsky to write the next one.
I would 100% read it. Yeah.
I mean, I think that'd be an amazing story. Like that's a movie. It may have already been a movie.
The Monuments Men. Yeah.
With
Matt Damon.
Yeah. I never saw it, but I think it's a cool idea. So yeah. So there were things in here that I quite liked, but overall it's like, it fell a little flat for me. And also just like, I was more interested in him meeting kind of artists that I didn't know as much about than, meeting Van Gogh, which is like a thing that seems to happen in pop culture.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Didn't we talk about that before? Wasn't it
Midnight in Paris?
Scorsese?
Oh, yeah. Kurosawa's Dreams. I was going to mention Kurosawa's... that. There's a segment where a young artist basically goes back into dreams. He dreams, obviously.
He dreams.
Meeting Van Gogh and Scorsese plays him. They have an interesting conversation about art and kind of why you create things and how you create them.
Oh, yeah. I put that in the show notes. That was good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I think a few years ago, Doctor Who did it as well. Like Van Gogh, traveled to the present day and was like shed a tear seeing people enjoy his work. I don't know. I have a limit on that kind of cheese myself. And so, yeah, like the Van Gogh's, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, Van Gogh. He's got a gun. That's interesting.
Yeah, was that? I don't know.
Was he? Yeah, because he didn't shoot his ear off. He cut it off.
But did he kill himself that way?
But he killed himself
with a gun. I'm pretty sure he killed himself with a gun. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like weird foreshadowing, though. But yeah. I don't know enough about the Van Gogh to really say one way or the other, but it felt like weird foreshadowing in the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, I mean, so that's my take on it. I like the stuff that Deb liked, and I didn't like the stuff that Chris didn't like. So I'm a perfect blending of the two of them.
Nice.
David, you brought this to us. So yeah. What are your thoughts on it?
Like Deb, I thought it was mostly fine. Like, it's definitely not the kind of like hardcore Jiro Taniguchi that we've covered before. That, you know, I went on a small journey to find Blasphemy to Japan, but the parts that were good, I thought were very good. Like the Van Gogh part, I agree with you that it's very overplayed. But as soon as they mentioned it, I was like, oh, are they going to do like the dreams thing and talk about art? And they did. And it's different from dreams. And I like having dueling perspectives, let's say. Not necessarily like equal and opposite, but like part of a spectrum on looking at something. Mm-hmm. So that this was very interesting from that perspective, kind of like, what did Taniguchi himself learn from these artists and what did he bring into his own art? And like, how is he filtering that now that he's going back to the source, well, you know, scare quotes source, and talking about this art? The other bit that I liked was the focus. I'm trying to find the page now. The Hoopla edition is a little tough to flick through. But he mentions a Japanese writer who praised a French artist, and no one knew the artwork that he was praising. Like, it was too new for Japan. And he was like, what one was it? Like, I got to find what he was looking at. I love that kind of journey. I think that's like so cool to be struck by something, but not be able to like grasp the whole of it and then go and find the whole, you know, it's like when you hear a line from a song, you're like, wow, that's like a really touching line. Then you hear the whole song. You're like, holy crap. Like, this is my new favorite thing.
Yeah.
Those kind of journeys are really interesting to me.
Yeah. And it's rare now. Like, that's the other thing I know. Like, when I hit that part, I'm just like, oh, yeah, like discovering a thing, but like you can't quite share it with other people because it's over here or you have a reproduction of it. Like, like nowadays, it's like, oh, yeah, I found a hot new song. I'm going to press a button and send it to all my friends. Like, it's a very different experience of discovery.
And we just did Manga, The World of Japanese Comics, which was very long because there's no pictures in it until the end.
Ugh.
But it's another book that's kind of like, hey, here's all this stuff that's really cool that we can't really show you, but it's good to know about. And one day you'll know more. And he kind of goes through a similar journey.
Yeah.
One of my favorite artists is Takehiko Inoue, who did Slam Dunk, Real, Vagabond. We'll probably end up doing Vagabond on the show at some point. But he has a book called Inoue Meets Godí, where he goes to Spain kind of studies the Spanish artist Godí. Like, he goes to like his houses, the places he painted, the subjects of his drawings. And it's like an artist doing arts criticism, but also kind of journaling about it at the same time.
Okay.
Like, why do I love this guy? What did he bring to his culture? What did he bring to my culture? What can I steal from his work? Like, the artist interchange thing, like across cultures, even just from artist to artist, is really cool. And from that perspective, I thought that this was really good in terms of an artist looking at art. But I share Chris's complaints about the narrative, that it's sort of like, he's just this guy. He's just a Taniguchi guy. And you can assume the dead wife thing a little earlier. There's like a little melancholy in there. But he's not as well-rounded as most Taniguchi guys.
Yeah.
But I think his observations about art definitely are. Like the different quotes and the walks that he goes on.
Well, I mean, he does actually introduce himself as a comic book artist. Like, he goes to a comic book show in Spain, and he's sick from being at the show, which is hilarious. Because
very relatable. I'm
pretty sure that him being sick from being at a show is actually how he died, which is huge bummer. Yeah, he died shortly after being at an event. There's a lot in this book that I actually want to dig into. And I didn't mean to cut you off there, David. I'm sorry. But
no, I was setting you up to reply angrily, so that was perfect.
Actually, I do have an angry reply for Chip, if that's okay.
Yeah, let's do it.
What?
So you didn't like that he was redrawing the art in his own style. I have a two-part question. They're both questions, though. This isn't a
question and a comic
convention panel. Yeah. First one, would it have been better if he inserted photographs of the art?
It's impossible. Like you can
because photographs of art aren't the art. It's worse, actually, in every way.
I don't think it's necessarily worse, but it would.
Oh no, it's worse, bro.
It would take you out of the story.
Yeah,
far too much to do that.
Two,
And the style would have to be close.
No, we're done. We're done. This is a question and answer session.
Wow.
If he was a painter, and if he painted this book, then I think insertion of paintings as the paintings, original paintings, would
work. He did paint this book. This is a watercolor book.
No, but like oils, or like oil, acrylic, like. Yeah, he didn't paint the book. Like, he added color to his intense line work. Like, the line work is the star of the show here.
I understand what you're saying. I think it is interesting, because if you see something like Venice, which is much more painterly, you might have a different impression of his work here. But you're right. I think you're right that the pencils are pretty overwhelming. But the second one is, in Preacher, there's a sequence where Cassidy talks about going to the MoCA, Museum of Contemporary Art. I think it's the MoCA, and seeing a painting called Christina's World. Or no, it was it wasn't Cassidy, it was Jesse. Seeing a painting called Christina's World, and it's a woman in a field sort of looking up at a farmhouse in the distance, and he goes to New York for the first time and sees his painting, and it changes his old world. And it was drawn in the book by Steve Dillon, and you know, it's a drawing in the Preacher style of that painting. It meant nothing to me. I was like, but I understood the idea of seeing a piece of art that transforms you. I got that. Mm-hmm. But when I went to the museum and saw Christina's World for the first time, it does. It knocks you on your ass.
Yeah,
it is shocking, the depth of that. So my question is, would it be better if that had been a photograph in Preacher? Would anything have mattered if he hadn't? Like, how was he supposed to do this if not painting it in his style?
No, in Preacher, just doing it in his style, I think, makes a lot of sense, because if every page had like fine art on it like this, then it's a different thing, right? But it's just a revealing a character thing in him. It's not about like getting across like the art itself. Like, it's such a small part of that larger narrative. I think that's fine. Like, I had to do it in Sex Criminals, because Matt had a thing in there for Starry Night, and I should look at it to make sure that what I did is what I said I did. but so what I did was, I took Starry Night, like the actual painting, and I simplified it just enough so it kind of matched with my style, but wasn't far off from the original. Like, to try and find that proper blend.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily enough, like, most people already know the painting, and things like Christina's World, like, that you can kind of, there's it's just a shortcut to it, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky thing. And, like, I would not have taken this job. Like, if I just wouldn't have done it, because I just don't think my art would do a disservice to the paintings. Because that's the focus of this whole book.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, my other question is, how much did the Louvre pay him?
Probably a lot.
Like, these books are great gigs. Everyone that's offered one takes one. I don't think anybody really turns it down. But their critical reception has been poor, basically, for almost all of these. The ones that are most successful are the artists who take that as a starting point and do something that you would never have seen coming. Like Rohan of the Louvre, for example, which is the JoJo's Bizarre Adventure spinoff. Mm-hmm. Or
Cats of the Louvre.
Which he just made it. He made it.
Cats of the Louvre?
He made it a chip. Cats of the Louvre by Taiyo Matsumoto, which is a two-volume one.
We got Chip with that one.
Yeah. He did a good job. I hope he bought a house. Oh, Marc-Antoine Mathieu, who's like a French cartoonist, he did one that is like purely a Marc-Antoine Mathieu book that just happens to take place in the catacombs underneath the Louvre, which most people don't get to see. Oh, so he was like, oh, so you just keep all these paintings? And they're like, yeah. And it's like, and it's a very old building, series of buildings. So there's like multiple basements. So he starts with like the basements that people have eventually get to see, but then he finds more basements, and that's where his story starts. And it's like, mm-hmm. how deep is the Louvre? And he keeps going down, and he keeps meeting head curators coming back up for like decades as he descends further and further to find these treasures underneath the Louvre. It's an amazing, he's a comics formalist, and he's really inventive, amazing take on it. It's probably my favorite of the Louvre books. Mm-hmm. Probably my favorite, actually, of his books, too, but he's a really interesting guy. Anyway.
How deep is the loop? How deep is the loop? I really need to know.
We need you to do a music video for the loop, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That's amazing. That's the way to do it.
I already know what the video that's going to end this week's show notes.
Yeah, that's beautiful. But so, Deb, can you talk to me about the saving the paintings from the Nazi chapter a little bit? Like, what was it that made it stand out for you?
Oh, just even just the minutia of what happened, like mm-hmm. the wrath of the Medusa being so big and putting it on a truck and then it running into the electricity wires.
Oh, yeah.
Overhead and almost frying it. Like, yeah. Oh, I did not know that at all. And can, like, you know, as someone who, you know, has a, like, not a big art collection, but stuff I treasure. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that painting and it's huge and it's magnificent. And the thought of losing it is horrifying, right? So it's just this, oh, I can't believe it got that close to being burned to a crisp, you know? It's like, and, you know, like, but so that drama, and so you feel that even if he didn't depict, you know, it to the level of drama that it could have. Mm-hmm. The part where they're talking about, and it's, you know, it's implied, but that, yeah, the Nazis did plunder a lot of art treasures, some that have never been seen in public again mm-hmm. after World War II. So the magnitude of the effort and what, you know, what was made possible by these people's sacrifices and efforts and, mm-hmm. you know, presence of mind, right? I mean, like, the Nazis are effing coming. And
yeah.
You are spending 12-hour days, maybe more, doing your damnedest to clear the house, right?
Yeah.
To get everything to someplace safe. I mean, your brain's working overtime. You're making plans. You're coordinating people. And it's the kind of tension and, you know, whatever can go wrong could go wrong kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I feel it. Like, is it an event planner? I feel it.
All I could think was when you get ready to move after spending like 5 years in the same place and buying books at, like, you know, our normal book reading pace and being like, why did I buy all these books? Like, this sucks.
Yeah. Except it's the Louvre.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't get to pick and choose at that point. But no, I think that chapter was maybe the most successful because it had that kind of narrative tension. The others were kind of like walks or travelogues, like Christopher said. It's like, here's a thing, here's some info about it, here's what I took from learning this info, and then, you know, on to the next chapter. But this one was kind of rooted in a place and time, I think, and the use of, like, the sepia tone almost on the sketches, on the drawings, was really interesting. And it felt more heavily photo referenced than the other chapters as well, which I think helps with the grounded feeling. Like, Taniguchi's already very grounded. So this is, basically real life at this point. Man, but the respect and love that the curators and the people have for the paintings, I thought was really good. And it sort of ties into something Chris said earlier about how you saw Christine's World. Is that what it was called?
Christina's World by Wyeth, yeah.
Christina's World, yeah. You saw it and it was huge. And I've had similar experiences in real life where you see a painting in a book, you're like, oh, that looks great. And then you see it in real life, you're like, oh, this is overwhelming. Like, I don't know what to do with this. And you've seen it in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. There's a bit where Cameron sees a painting and just, like, sits there for a while. There's a moment in The Sopranos where Carm sees a painting. I can't remember the name of it, but it was like a mother and child thing. And, like, it really messes her up. She's like, oh, the baby, he's so innocent, and, like, basically crying.
Wow.
No subtext. It's, like, very obvious what they're getting at. But I think that the side, the, like, physical dimensions of the paintings is an interesting thing that we don't cover very often in, like, cultural criticism, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because people talk about the Starry Night being smaller than they expect. And a lot of the paintings, like, you know, the Delacroix about with the, you know, the France leading the people to victory, the one where she's holding the flag and she's got half her boob showing and stuff like that. Like, it's freaking huge.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's massive.
Yeah. The first time I saw that, because I took a 19th century art history right before my first trip to Paris, I dragged my sister to the Louvre with me. And I knew all the stories about all these, you know, paintings because I had taken this art history. I had a really good teacher My sister at halfway through that day said, "Deb, I don't care. Where's the frickin' Mona Lisa? Let's go."
Yeah.
And so we made an agreement after that, that she would go shopping. I would stay in the Louvre and we would meet for dinner.
Nice. Yeah. Working at cross purposes. The physical dimension, the physical aspects of these paintings, of artwork, I guess, is very important. And Christopher, you said you wanted to talk about Shintoism a little bit on that. Am I correct in guessing you're going towards kind of an animist thing, like the souls of paintings?
Yeah, actually. Before we segue to that, I don't know, this is going to come off like a humble brag, but I actually just went to, I was just in Europe, actually, and we did a lot of museums. And Louvre on the last trip, when I was actually there with Deb, and Louvre is overwhelming, but yeah, the art is big, but even when it's not big, it can be powerful. Like I went to the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam. Everyone should go if you can go, if you can get tickets. It's not too expensive, but it is full of tourists. Seeing Van Gogh's art in person, it's no matter what reproductions you've seen, you really haven't seen it, especially because he's in his later period, just slathering the paint on. And I really think that this book does a good job at showing the awe of the art. And size is a really easy way for us to talk about it on a podcast, or it's an easy way for him to talk about it because he's just doing reproductions. But like depth and the color, just it's shocking. It is shocking seeing original artwork of comics too, honestly. Getting to see any kind of original is actually amazing. Like I'm so lucky to have gotten to do that for as long as I did. But I really do think that this book does express love of seeing original artwork. And I think that that's one of the things that I really like about it, even if I don't always love the narrative stuff and of preserving it and of like being devoted to it, the Nazi chapter in particular. But I mentioned Shintoism because, this book does read like a Japanese dude doing his book about France, which I think is pretty great. So it's like, okay, I'm going to go to the Louvre and I'm going to like, oh, everything's got a soul in it. Which is like a core Shintoist belief. It's an animist, you know, religion coming out of Japan where everything's got a soul in it. That's very Japanese. Talking about the two Japanese guys that have anything to do with the Louvre is a very Japanese move for a guy doing a book about the Louvre. Yeah, it's like, oh, did you know that this guy studied there and this guy's art was at an exhibition of Japan art in Japan in like the Taisho era? Like, whoa, you know, like I thought it's the most Japanese you could probably make a book about the Louvre because there's very few connections, I think. And he's got them all in there, including bios of some of the painters and artists at the back, which I thought was kind of a nice touch. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the idea of everything having a spirit and then talking to the spirit in that object and treating it as a sign of respect to the spirit, stay happy, is actually a really interesting lens to view it through. And again, it's you start with that place, and I wish it would have... Like, I wish it had been more anecdotal rather than less. Instead of just getting one big anecdote per chapter, if it was just like, here's every weird thing I learned about on my walkthrough of the Louvre, talking to the museum curators, as expressed by different paintings or different objects of art, that'd be kind of fun, right? Like, that'd be kind of cool. Yeah. Or if it had been a more consistent narrative or like whatever. But yeah, I think the fact that he did pull this like very Japanese Shintoist take to tell his story about this French, you know, icon, I thought was probably one of the most interesting parts of the book, at least in terms of how he conceptualized this book.
Yeah, I think that's true. And there's such a, obviously this probably was not on his mind when he was making it, but like nowadays, 2024, there's such like a devaluation of art, or actually devaluation of artists, and then art in addition to that, that I think this kind of loving, you know, like, here's why all this stuff rules and it's good, and also we should respect it more kind of approach is resonant, I would say.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Oh, wait, does AI art have a soul? Discuss.
No, they're robots. We settled this. But I don't know, I've spent the past year and a half-ish doing art lessons. Like, I might have mentioned on the podcast before, I drew a lot as a kid, up until like my junior year of high school when I realized writing was easier and switched to an English major. And now I'm trying to get it back. And a lot of that has been studying artists and kind of doing what the protagonist in this book is doing, which is like looking at an artist and trying to figure out what they were thinking, why they were solving problems this way. And also like what it has to do with my life, because like art is a conversation between artists and artists and art as well. So I kind of really enjoyed this book for the respect that it shows the art, even in how he makes it. Like, all of the buildings look perfect. All of, like, the folds in the jacket. Mm. Like, there's such a clarity and care in the artwork. And I think that kind of ties into what you were saying about it being important to treat it with respect and, like, with as if it has a soul.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Taniguchi's a cool guy.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, talk of, like, the animus and kind of, like, spirit representation of the artwork, like how bad this book would have been if it was the Mona Lisa walking around.
Can I just say that this is not how I imagined the winged victory of Samothrace to look with her head?
No,
me either.
Yeah.
That, like, with the two little cinnamon buns on her head, like, look like balls of yarn. It's like,
yeah.
And then she has, like, almost no expression throughout the entire book. She's like, she has an expression that like a docent would have that has given the tour thousands of times before.
Yeah. She is sick of this.
Kind of can't muster up the energy to care that much, but isn't so cynical as to seem unhappy. They're just kind of like, yes, this place has a lot of history. Sure does.
I love the thought of her being fed up with all these feverish weirdos coming to the museum.
Oh, boy. See, that's your aloof book.
Yeah. That'd be so funny. But, like, page 31 in the Hoopla edition is him, like, looking at the statue after the reveal happens. He's saying, you know, good Lord, it can't be.
Yeah.
Like, that kind of twist where you see the thing the person's hallucinating and you see the real thing. I feel like it's really hacky, but I didn't mind it here because it kind of fits the explainer tone of the book.
Yeah. It's also a really lovely page.
Like, yeah, just that
the,
too.
The space given to it, the reveal.
And the lights going past them. It's so talented.
Yeah. And the scale that he shows of this, right? Like, the one thing that blew me away every time I go to Lubin, I've been about 3 times in the last 5 years.
Wow.
Just because when you go, that's where you go.
Yeah.
When you go to Paris, that's where you go. And sometimes you go more than once. The scale of stuff, right? Like, you see photos, but nothing prepares you for, like, how big things are or how small they are or looking really closely, you can see the brush strokes and the, you know, the age of the things.
I was amazed when I found out the statue of David is 17 feet tall. You know?
Yeah. When I saw David, it blew my mind, actually. That was one of those ones where there's a replica of it outside of, like, the main square where everything is. But then you actually have to go to a special little museum down the street. And because you see it outside, and it's outside in, like, this huge square. It's up against other statues. And you're like, oh, that's really impressive. But when you go and see it inside, this, and it's in a gallery that's built for it, the scale of it changes so much because you're enclosed and there's nothing else around it to, like, make it seem less important, I guess.
Yeah.
Or just one of a series. And it's just shocking. Like, it's so shocking.
I heard that the size of it is because, like, Michelangelo started with the penis. And his benefactor was like, it's a small penis, right? He's like, yeah, of course. And then chiseled the rest out and made David huge to make the penis seem smaller.
Artists do that all the time. Adjusting proportions based on, like, one bad measurement happens all the time.
Exactly.
It's such a BL kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
I'm sure it has been. Yeah. Oh, man. So we should probably do Chip's Color Corner and then get into some final thoughts. So this is a fully painted manga. We've only done, I don't know, like 2 or 3 of these so far, maybe?
Yeah, it is. I didn't realize it was fully painted. So the first 5 pages, I was just like, oh, I'm gonna have to do a Chip's Color Corner. And then I'm like, oh, the whole thing's painted.
Yeah.
It's nice.
Yeah, I found it very pleasant.
It's nice. Yeah.
I would have liked a little more atmosphere, I think. Everything's a little bit in a daytime register, I feel like. And once in a while, I would have liked a little bit more nighttime or a little bit more dusk or golden hour or something. But that's, like, such a minor complaint.
Is the Louvre open at night?
No, but the area surrounding it is, and the rest of Paris is, like,
okay.
He could have gone for dinner instead of breakfast at one point. I think it would have been lovely.
It's a literal book that is, like his skin tone does not change throughout the book. His jacket color does not change. Like, nothing changes throughout this, just depending on his his delusional fantasy scenario. Like, you know, myself, I'd just be like, oh, if I was, like, if I switch over to the Van Gogh setting, I would do it at like sunset or something, like just change it up to kind of create some variety between the scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a straight up literal straight through. But I mean, it's fine. It's one of the nicer ones that we've seen, I think, in terms of Chip's color corner.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. It enhances the work instead of detracts from it.
A standout page for me was page 75, where Van Gogh is showing the protagonist like some sketches and paintings. And there's like a black and white version of one of Van Gogh's sketches.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. The contrast is so good. Also, the audacity to do a sketch of someone else's sketch is like an interesting artistic challenge, I think.
Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's nice balance on the page.
He does it in such an interesting way. And I do love that even when he's trying to draw like foreigners, like white people, they still kind of look like Taniguchi characters. Just looking at this, it's like just blurring it, you know, like he's moving the slider as far as he can move it, but it still looks like he's in a Taniguchi manga, which I think is great.
Yeah.
Even the jackets on this page, you know, they're both wearing, like, Van Gogh has a very period-appropriate jacket. The modern guy has his own kind of, like, I don't know, kind of shiny jacket. The textures and, like, the folds. I don't know, it's easy to see why Taniguchi was such a respected artist in his time.
Yeah.
Just so professional.
Yeah. Guy knows how to draw.
Yeah.
Can I ask something off mic for a sec? Deb, you're the only one with a real book, right?
Yep.
Can you go to the page where David was just talking about, page 75 for me? Or 74, actually. It's the one before that. And it's when he's talking to Van Gogh. And in the lower left-hand corner, Van Gogh is puffing, maybe one more.
One more.
He's
this one?
Puffing on a...
This one?
Yeah. The lower left-hand corner, Van Gogh is saying, "I wonder if you are afflicted by some nervous disorder as well." Is the U, Y-O-U, underlined, or is it
that bolded? Happened several times. It should have been bolded. So in lettering and scripts, we'll use underline to indicate bold italic. And I bet that their Illwind pseudonym didn't know about that. So there's several points where there's underlined letters.
Okay. I thought it was just something that was like maybe not rendered correctly in the digital edition, but no.
Yeah, there's also period ellipses a lot of places.
Yeah.
Yeah, Keep this in. I know you're saying do it like, off mic, but like that's interesting. I didn't know that like underlining meant that. Like,
oh, I guess that's mongosplaining, isn't it, right?
Yeah, it's literally what we're here for.
I don't know. It just bumps me out because it's we're not. Chip's making us keep it in.
I think it's good because this also speaks to something else about the project, which is that the Louvre doesn't do comic books. So I think there are certain things that would slip through the cracks here and there.
Another thing that's wrong in this is that the digital edition I've got that flips left to right, but the panels read right to left.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, same. That's Comixology.
And it's just like, well, I don't even, it's Kindle on mine. I wish I could get the Comixology version. They've discontinued it, unfortunately. Yeah, and it's just, oh, wow, why is it printed so small? Ugh.
Oh, that's obnoxious.
It's a bummer.
I mean, I'm glad I have the book because the book is quite nice. It's a hardcover.
Yeah, it's huge. It's oversized.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I guess the book is way big.
Really, I think I would prefer this digitally rather than in print because of, like I mentioned, it's kind of like a slight as a story.
Like the size.
Yeah, it's like album size, the print edition.
Because it was printed. It was meant to be printed in France at this size.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. An album size.
Oh, I got to ask, and you can do the off thing, but what's the flying snot? Is it glass or is it snot? What is it?
No, that's the Guardian. That's them the Guardian. Their Guardian unrealized form.
Oh.
That's the spirit.
Like ideas.
And it does look a little bit like flying snot.
Well, because in the beginning he talks about his mucous membranes being inflamed, so I thought it
was... Yeah,
little snot maybe. Sculptures.
Oh my God. Wow.
Just saying.
Yeah. But it is interesting, the different kind of formatting. I guess formatting is the best word for it. The different formatting troubles we run into, reading manga from a bunch of different companies and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
NBM has maybe published 2 manga. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
This and that Rocky one.
Man.
The snot thing on page 21, the big reveal of all the snot things. I found that pretty underwhelming.
Mm.
Like visually, it's just like, what? Like, that's how you wanted to show these guardians that inhabit the Louvre?
Yeah, I didn't.
Yeah,
I didn't love it, especially because it's such a nice drawing of the Louvre behind the snot thing.
Yeah, no, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous drawing.
Did I ruin it for everyone by calling it snot?
No, that's just, the,
you're right.
Accurate.
You're right.
Because I wondered whether it was pieces of glass or I don't know.
Yeah, it's just like floating spirits, but they're like Slimers.
Yes,
oh man,
yes, Ghostbusters.
Yeah. On that, full of Slimers.
The Louvre is going to hear this podcast and ban us all for life.
Yeah. They're not approaching me for a new volume, that's for sure.
No, they might call us, say, let's get the David Brothers Chip Zdarsky's Louvre.
Yeah, it would be great.
You're so good. Let's see what you do.
Because they don't want the Louvre, the Debaoki Louvre store, which is just me bickering with my sister.
I mean, that would actually be a better narrative than this, I think. Like, that kind of division between, like, I'm here to, like, see the Mona Lisa and I'm here to experience, like, the art.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's an interesting story.
We need Maga-splaining at the Louvre.
Yeah, I think we should all do like a Louvre story. We should pitch the Louvre and be like, all right, give us four stories and we'll wow you.
Nice.
It'd be cute. And then Chris's one would be him and Andrew admiring it. And then Andrew explaining everything. And Chris is like, I really need a soda right now.
Yeah, I'd sit down with the Coke, actually.
Andrew would explain it all in French, in the original language of the artist.
Yeah.
Oh, man. On that note, Deb, do you have a final thought for us on Guardians of the Louvre and its Slimers?
I mean, I think it's a lovely book. I'm glad that I waited until now to read it because I can enjoy it fresh.
Yeah.
And, you know, given that the reason why I didn't read it was, you know, the impression that Chrissy gave me is like, it's the least successful of his books. And it's like, oh, this actually isn't as bad as that.
It's actually least more successful of a genius. Yeah.
Yes, it's really interesting. And as someone who does watercolor, and I'm looking at the paintings and stuff like that, I think, how long did he take him to do this?
The holy buildings, crap. Like,
yeah.
All the drawings and all the photos and all the,
yeah,
all the line work and all the painting. It's like, I look at this, it's like, this would take me 2 years to do it.
Yeah.
I'm just amazed at the effort, and it's really lovely. You know, as souvenirs that you can get from the Louvre, it is actually one of the nicer ones, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It is out of the three Louvre manga books I've read, I would say Cats of the Louvre is the best, Rohan at the Louvre is second, and maybe this is third. But, you know, given those three, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. And Christopher, how about you? Have we shifted your opinion of this book at all in discussing it, the manga-splaining way?
I really do think it's a gorgeous book. Still, I'm all name droppy this. I got to see all the original art for this book. It was exhibited. There was an exhibition at the Italian Cultural Institute. No, this one was actually at Angoulême. Sorry, I got to see all the originals, and there was a video of him talking about making this book. Not all the originals, but some of them. Like the video talking about him making this book, and the anecdote that I'm pretty sure I remember, I'll see if I can find it for the show notes, but if I could provide, you know, actual attributions, they can add it to his Wikipedia, is that he was shown to the Louvre. He got to go early before it opened, and he was shown around and toured around, and he wanted to capture the feeling of being the only person at the Louvre. Because then, like an hour and a half later, it was full of people again. And I think anyone who does one of these books, I think Hayao Matsumoto said the same thing. You get to go to the Louvre either after hours or before hours when it's closed. I think Matsumoto chose after because his book is about when the Louvre closes at night and what happens when it closes at night. It's Cats of the Louvre. And I think that it did a really good job of communicating that, of like showing this beautiful, it is a truly beautiful, incredibly dense, a magnificent series of buildings. He communicates what it's like to be there, to be the only person, just you and the artwork, really well. And that's probably my biggest takeaway from this. Yeah, I didn't get to see an original Van Gogh until I was in my like late 30s. And I'd been looking at art and books since I was a little kid, like my whole life, and loving art. So it is a tremendous joy to get to go and originally see original art paintings and sculptures and artifacts and antiquities and all of it. And I'm so glad I get to do it. It overwhelms me. Like, I can only spend about 2 hours in a museum before I have to go like have lunch, and maybe I'll go back or sit down and have a Coke, as Deb said, because I was pretty cranky. We had to get up real early to go to the Louvre. But it is truly phenomenal. And it's one of the things that we've been trying to do since we moved to Taipei, is take in original artwork here as well and see like the Taiwanese artists, both comics artists and traditional artists and mixed media and futuristic artists. And I went to an exhibition this weekend. So yeah, I love that this book loves art, and he gets to talk about his favorites and probably be paid very well for it. And I know it sold gangbusters in France too. It sold huge. I don't think it did anything in English, unfortunately. But there's two editions of this, and there's three editions in French, including like a super special edition, and one they printed it in black and white for some reason. I don't know why.
Wow.
So I will say that is the thing that this book does, is communicates a feeling and a love of art and makes you want to go out and see original art. And I think that's, you know, super cool. Super, super cool. Oh, and also I messed up earlier. I said MoCA when I meant MoMA, because MoCA is the name of the one here and in Toronto, yeah, but yeah. MoMA is the New York. Sorry, go see the MoMA. It'll be correct in the show notes. Chip.
I got a couple things here. One, I love the fact that the person here who liked the book the least got to see the original art. It's like finding out that your friend who's not that into Taylor Swift got front row seats. No? Yeah, yeah. You've given me another idea. I think we should approach the Louvre about each of us doing a story, because the setup is ripe for a manga-splaining heist. Being left alone in the Louvre.
What's the one painting you would steal? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh,
man. And then I get lost, and I take the wrong way, and I get stuck in the African art wing, and which is a dead end.
Yeah.
Which says so much about the Louvre that it's a dead end.
Yeah, David, what's your final thought?
I liked it, but I think I liked talking about it with you three more than reading it. It was one, like, some books where you read and they're good, and there's others where it's like they're okay, but you know the conversation's going to be good. And this hits on so many different things that, like, I'm into, that we're collectively into. The Alone in the Museum thing is really a really nice fantasy.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely worth checking out. I don't know if I would go for the print edition necessarily. I mean, I have the print edition, thanks to Deb's kindness,
I actually would. That's the only thing I disagree with you on. The quality of the artwork in the Kindle, and I've got it on like a big iPad, like a big screen. They just didn't submit a high enough resolution file for my tastes. I think there's a lot to be said for a really beautiful book, frankly, in hardcover and full color and whatever. But luckily it's out of print, so you win the day, actually. Someone's got to get it on Hoopla or got to get the digital.
I mean, a journal of my father was like one of the only ones that I got the physical edition of for the podcast. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad I did. Like, it's so beautiful on that paper.
What we need are lossless digital comics that are printed like at print resolution, 600 DPI, 20 gigs each for the download.
Yeah.
Sorry, you guys, for the publishers I work with, that's how I get the manga, actually. I get the print files. Are you guys not reading lossless digital comics?
Printing my own editions at Walgreens.
You are full of the humble bag today, ain't you, Chris?
Chris, we get it. You're a big deal. Well, I also want to point out that I just was looking up Jiro Taniguchi, and him and Chris are both knights of arts and letters in France. It's like one of the primary things in his Wikipedia. I'm like, just like my friend Christopher Butcher.
They sit next to each other at the big table of knights each year.
Sounds like the French guys were that was Wikipedia.
In heaven.
Yeah, he's dead. I'm not sitting next to him anywhere yet.
Yeah. Anymore.
In a few years.
Yeah.
You didn't get a chance to meet him when he was alive, did you, Chris?
No, I really tried, actually. We invited him to TCAF 5 times, actually.
Wow.
And this is going to bum you all out, but he didn't want to come because no one reads his books in English. All of the print runs for his books are so small. And, you know, not a knock on Ponant Mon. They put them out, but I don't think any of the print runs are more than 2,000 or 3,000 copies. And it was just like, why would I go somewhere where no one knows who I am? And it's like, I'm the director of the festival. I'm like your biggest English language fan. And he's like, thanks. This is a shortened version of 5 years worth of conversations. Some of them through Stephen, some through Shogakukan direct, or Shogakukan, I think, is his publisher. And it's just a matter of like, this is a guy who's an artist's artist. I think he's someone that some people really love, And he's huge in France. He's La Poupée. Sorry, that was a Kids in the Hall reference for those of you, or the Poopy.
What I thought I heard was like, why would I come to North America when France is going to treat me like a king?
And they did.
Anytime I go.
Do you think he was paying for that hotel in the beginning of this book? No, that was clearly something like the Louvre was paying for that hotel. Yeah, the Louvre invited him to stay for a week to take photos and make a book about the Louvre, and not only paid for him, paid him to do it. Like, that's how he got treated in France versus the only book of his in English that got a second printing is The Walking Man. And they reprinted it when they did the hardcover a couple of years for the 10th anniversary, 15th anniversary. So it's just like, yeah, it's a bummer. We just don't read enough art manga in English. I'm doing my best. Okinawa's doing real well. Like, we're all trying real hard, actually. Yeah. But yeah, it's tough. It's really, really tough. So I didn't get to meet him, but I did get to go and see his original art like three times at different locations. And it was all amazing. And I got to actually, here's another friggin' clang. I was in Tokyo. Name drop. That's the clang is the noise of the name drop. I was in Tokyo and I got invited to a book signing at the French bookstore in Tokyo. It's called Le Petit Renard. It's the little fox. And it's a cute little.
Is that automatic when you're a French knight? You always get invited to?
Yeah, yeah. They're like, there's a knight in town. Invite him.
You're on the mailing list. Yeah,
yeah. I'm on the mailing list. Actually, Frederick, who's the Tezuka agent who got a Search and Destroy for Mangasplaining, was the person who invited me because he knew the French bookstore because he's Frederick. So of course he did. And I went there and the proprietor of the bookstore was Taniguchi's French agent and editor. Ooh. He worked with Taniguchi directly on, I think, maybe this and Venice and the children's book and a couple of other projects. And I bought a book by Brecht Evans. Brecht Evans is an amazing Belgian cartoonist, like truly sensational. And he did this travelogue, Louis Vuitton travelogue situation. And he's like, Brecht Evans, do you like his work? It's like, yeah, he's my favorite. He's one of my favorites. I'm glad I got it. He's like, did you get the Taniguchi one? And I was like, actually, I didn't buy it because I already bought it. It's back in Canada. But I love Taniguchi. I've gotten to see his art a number of times. And I was rattling off all the things. And I was switching between French and English when I didn't have the French words. And he's like, you strike me as a real fan of Jiro Taniguchi. And he pulls out from under the desk, like Bergamo, like Peter Bergamo runs The Beguiling does sometimes, and just gives me this portfolio. And it is a portfolio booklet situation that was created to promote the French release of the Jiro Taniguchi Venice book. And he's like, here you go. And I'm like, I'm sorry, what? And he's like, here you go. And I'm like, looking at it, and I'm like, oh, thank you. And I hand it back to him. He's like, no, that's for you. He's like, I got a couple when I was his editor. Oh my God. And so I've got this insanely rare promo thing. And I'll be honest, because it's a Jiro Taniguchi episode, I will let myself have an emotion. I was like, I just need a second to go talk to my husband. I'll be right back, but I'll buy this, you know, thank you. And I just went outside and I cried for like 10 minutes because it had been a stressful couple of years. Like I was in Tokyo having moved to Taiwan and I, you know, post COVID and the move and stuff like that. And it all just came out, this act of kindness from this stranger of this amazing thing, just because I was like, I'll share my love of Taniguchi's work with this one guy. And he rewarded it at like an equal level, actually. And it was insane. And so I was just crying on the streets of Tokyo. These old people are walking by like, why is this guy crying outside of the foreign language bookstore? It killed me. And I went back inside and I was like, I'd stop crying. He's like, I didn't know how much it would mean to you. I'm so happy, actually. I'm like, great, here you go. And then I, you know, bought £150 worth or euros worth of books. But it was great. It was like,
he could see you crying through the window.
I went to an alley like a good. Yeah. I apologize. And I just said it meant a lot. He got it because he's French. He gets it. It pains me to not actually like Guardians of the Louvre. It really does. But it is beautiful. And I'm so glad I've got this Venice book and all the other stuff that goes with it. But yeah, it had been a really hard time. And it was a truly amazing act of kindness that someone showed me, just who he had just met that day. And I will never forget that. So Le Petit Renard, it's in North Tokyo, north of Ikebukuro. If you're looking for French books in Tokyo for some reason, can't recommend it highly enough. I go now every time I'm back.
Nice. On that note, we're going to take a break. We're going to run an ad and then we're going to come back and do some shout outs. We will see y'all in a bit.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by Walden University. Ever catch yourself thinking, What if I could go after what I actually want and really make a difference? You're not alone, and that's exactly why I want to tell you about Walden University. For over 50 years, Walden has helped working adults like you get the W with the knowledge and skills to build the future you want and make a difference where it matters most. If you've been waiting for the right moment, this is it. Head to waldenu.edu and take that first step. Walden University, set a course for change, certified to operate by Chev.
And we are back. We've had a really fun conversation about Jiro Taniguchi and Guardians of the Louvre, published by NBM, translated by Kumar Suvasubramanian. And now we are going to shout out some stuff, maybe books, maybe music, maybe movies. I don't know. Let's see. Chip, what do you got for us?
Well, I recently went on vacation for 3 whole days.
All right.
On a beach. So I was able to actually sit and read a couple of books. So my shout out is Zadie Smith's The Autograph Man, which I didn't know anything about it. I've read a couple of her books before, and I really love her writing. And so I just kind of picked it up from my local used bookstore. And it's about autograph collectors. It's about a guy and his cohorts who basically buy and sell and trade autographs, and about him and his group of friends. And yeah, so it's like, it was weird to read it because it's like there's kind of a connection to comic books in it. Like he goes to autograph conventions and stuff, and it's all about value of signatures. And so I got a kick out of that. It's one of those books that I'm like, I'm shouting it out only if you, it's a very funny book, but only if you're okay with the main character being kind of not irredeemable, but just like, he doesn't really grow much during this, and he definitely want his friends to dump his ass.
Yeah.
But I kind of love those characters, so I quite love this book. So yeah, The Autograph Man.
Nice. And Deb, what do you have for us?
Well, I went to a Pride in Panels, which is the first gay comics festival at San Francisco Public Library, run partly because I'm a teacher at CCA. So it was organized by Justin Hall, who's the dean at the MFA in comics program, who is my boss. But also several of my students were exhibiting there, which is lovely. But then one of the main reasons why I went was because I wanted to meet Kyla Aiko in person. And she's the letterer who's working on our book, No Roses Without Thorns. Mm. She is a cartoonist. She lives in Honolulu. And she's a letterer with Viz and a couple other companies. But I bought two of her mini comics. One is called What Could Have Been. And the other one is called Ni Hao. And What Could Have Been is about a Chinese American girl who got adopted and grew up in the U.S. and then went back to the home village where she was originally from. And she's reflecting on what could have been if she had stayed in China. And then the other one is this little mini comic called Ni Hao, which is about as an Asian person, yes, you do deal with people come up to you and say, Ni Hao, Ma. And you go, I'm Japanese, but hi, how are you? And I don't know the way to Chinatown. I don't live in this city. But it's a little tiny little comic about what she calls microaggressions. So you can see more of her at aikosmith.com, and she is working on a middle grade graphic novel called Foxlight from Fywell and Friends. And we were talking at lunch the other day, and she said, yes, it's coming out in 2027.
Wow.
And I said, are you kidding? You're working on it now and it's coming out in 2027?
Yeah.
Like that's...
It's a generous deadline.
Yeah.
No, it's ridiculous.
how long is it?
800 pages.
Yeah.
I have no idea. Anyway, go check it out. It was really lovely to meet her, and she's doing fantastic work on No Roses Without Thorns, which I hope we can hopefully update with a release date sometime. But everyone said, I told you so. This publishing manga thing is not fast or easy.
Sometimes it takes a while.
Yeah. It takes a while.
Nice. And Christopher, what do you have for us?
Actually, I'm going to follow on Deb's enlightened self-interest there. We're actually, by the time this comes out, we will have finished serializing our big book, which Deb is editing, which is Wandering Cat's Cage by Kanai Torakai on mangasplainingextra.com. And it's just so good. Like the ramp up to the end is just like a nail biter, and it's really, really good. And yeah, the team on that, which is Jocelyn Allen is a translator, and it was lettered by Sarah Lindsay. Yeah, Sarah Lindsay lettered it, and it looks great. It's going to be good. It's coming out from Fantagraphics. It looks like it's slipped to 2026 just so we can have enough time to properly promote it. It's funny, actually, because for bookmark it, you really got to have a long lead time. Like they want 12 months if they can get it to really promote it. And it worked well for Okinawa. Like that slipped like 6 months and that just gave us six more months to promote it and put it in people's hands and get it in front of the ALA and stuff. And it's been winning a lot of awards because of that, which is great. We just finished book two of Search and Destroy as well. And that's another one that is like real heavy, really, really enjoying that as well. So yeah, Manga Explaining Extra. We just finished two books and we've got a third one on the way and some more stuff to show you. So yeah, check it out. The newsletter, the bonus articles, all the stuff. Actually, I'm probably going to put a bunch of the Taniguchi artwork that I photographed and wasn't supposed to up on Manga Explaining Extra to coincide with this episode. So we'll have something to look at too.
Cool.
And David, what's yours?
I've got a co-shout out or a double shout out. Conditional shout out. We'll go with that. If you live in California, in the Bay Area, and this is kind of tying into the theme of the episode, you should go to the Oakland Museum of California. It's my favorite museum. I actually live basically walking distance from it, which is kind of cool.
Wow.
But they have a California history section and then also a California art gallery, which is all California artists from throughout history. There's photography, there's sculpture, paintings, like more avant-garde stuff. There's like local stuff by like modern day people today who are just making art. There's tons of stuff in there. It's really cool to see, really well curated. One of my favorite places on earth. If you do not live in Oakland, you can, Passion has a series of very affordable like art history books. It costs like $20 each on a number of subjects. I got Van Gogh, there's M.C. Escher, H.R. Giger, pretty much anyone you could think of. You can find a nice little like tidy book that you could read in an afternoon about their work. Like just pick one, find one, read it and learn something. Like there's always something cool about the stuff that we like and the stories behind it, like how they got to be who they are, why they chose to express what they're doing. I don't know. Art's pretty cool. And I've been fortunate enough to dedicate my life to it. So there we go.
You sucker.
Yeah, right.
Dedicating your life to art.
What nobody told me is that art doesn't pay. That's the one downside.
Yeah. until we get that Louvre money, right? Yeah. Mom gang.
Oh, now I don't know what. Ooh, let's put it in the show notes. Yeah. Let's all think on it. What are we stealing from the Louvre? We all get one.
All right.
The Statue of David, obviously.
No,
I would have put it in my apartment.
That's in,
where is it?
That's
in Italy.
That's in Italy. Yeah. That's okay. In Florence.
So yeah, they got two heists.
you guys, it's foolish to steal the art. Just steal their money.
That's a good point.
Wow. Yeah, you say that, but do you have a Rembrandt? Because I could use a Rembrandt.
Yeah, but what are you going to do with it? Like you hang it up your right home? Like, this is from when I stole it from the Louvre. Like what?
Imagine if you came over to hang out and the Statue of David was in my like
hallway. I think it's just the
bottom half.
Yeah, right David, the Statue of David.
Yeah. That's amazing. Man. All right, we're going to call it here, and we will see you all next week. Thanks for listening.